Toward the end of AD 70, it is estimated that the Romans crucified 500 Jews per day outside the walls of Jerusalem. That's 500 per day in AD 70 that were crucified. According to the ancient historian Josephus, who was writing around the time, there was, he says, no space left for crosses and no crosses left for bodies. In other words, even if they could find a space outside the walls, and even if they could get a spot, they still had the trouble of finding enough wood for the crosses. That's how many people were up there. That's how many people were being crucified back then in AD 70. And yet Christians have the nerve to claim Jesus' death was special. Christians claim his crucifixion was unique. 500 every day outside Jerusalem, just like him. They say there was not one like it, before or after. They say that his cross was not just one among many. How do we claim such a thing? Why do we claim such a thing? What gives Christians the right? Well, tonight we're simply going to appreciate this passage a little more so that we can appreciate the death of Jesus a little more. It's a simple sermon with a simple goal. Appreciate this passage a little more to appreciate the death of Jesus a little more and find out what makes it so truly unique. Well, so far for chapter after chapter after chapter, in fact, for literally half of this book of Samuel, we have been waiting for this moment. For literally half of this book, we've been waiting for Saul to be swept out of the way. Not only has Saul been trying to kill David, he has set out to take David's life, and in the process, he's been led to commit all sorts of terrible things, such as killing a village, a whole village of uninvolved priests in a brutal way. Not only has Saul been actively trying to kill David, but he's ultimately been blocking the way for David to come to the throne. He's ultimately been stopping the way for David to come to the throne. And so God's plans for his people haven't been able to go ahead. Chapter after chapter after chapter, any reader, you know, for literally half the book, any reader has been waiting for this moment. We've been waiting for Saul to be taken out of the way. And yet this chapter is not a cause for celebration. Not yet. This chapter is not a cause for exaltation. Even though we've been waiting for the moment. Even though we've been waiting for Saul to be taken out of the way. Even though God is going to use his death to bring about a great victory for David, this chapter is first of all saying stop. This chapter is first of all saying look. This chapter is first of all saying listen. This chapter is first of all saying lament. Put on clothes of mourning. Lament at Saul's death. This passage is teaching us, first of all, to bow our heads. This passage is teaching us, first of all, to beat our breasts. This passage is teaching us, first of all, to put on the clothes of mourning, the garments of grief. Because this chapter is saying, even though it's Saul, he still is the king. And even though it's Saul, the king is dead. Stop, look, listen. Learn to lament. Put on the garments of grief. The king is dead. So I want us to do that. I want us to put on those garments of grief to lament. And then I want us to move on from that. If we are to lament Saul, how much more should we lament for Jesus? This is teaching us to lament for Saul. And if we're going to lament for Saul, how much more should we lament for the true king? The one who was righteous. So that's what we're going to do as well. We're going to appreciate Jesus' death as something we need to lament as well as a great victory. Yeah, it was a great victory, something to rejoice in, but it's also something to sorrow over. Even though it was a great victory, God's king still did die. And so there are our 2 points for tonight. Point one, victory even in death. Victory, that's point one. And then point two, God's king still did die for that to happen. God's king still did die. So first of all, then victory. Even in defeat, there is a victory. Have a look at verse 8. In the middle of the passage, verse 8. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armour, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple, of their idols and among their people. They put his armour in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. This is not the first time we've seen this in Samuel, in the book of Samuel, and it's certainly not going to be the last. God hands his people over to defeat. In fact, you could say God hands himself over to defeat. Because this news of Saul, literally it says the good news of Saul's death. Or you could even say, you could even translate it, the gospel of Saul's death. This good news of Saul's death is not just proclaimed in the cities, and this news is not just proclaimed in the streets of the Philistines. All the markets, all the shops, all the towns, where is it also proclaimed? Look, it's also proclaimed in the temples of the Philistines. And what it's saying is this: our gods have defeated Israel's gods. When it comes to Israel's God, our gods are number one. So this isn't just God handing his people over to defeat. Nah, you could easily say this is God handing himself over to defeat in this chapter. In a great Tasmanian book, Richard Flanagan's book, Death of a River Guide, a rafting leader gets trapped beneath a waterfall on the Franklin River out here on the west coast of Tas. And as he lay there dying, his whole life flashes before his eyes. And that's actually the book. The book, you actually get to live his whole life as it flashes before his eyes. But not just his life. It's actually the life of his father and grandfather and even his ancestors as well. This chapter is a lot like that. Because as Saul lays on Mount Gilboa dying, his whole life starts to flash before our eyes. But again, not just his life, it's the life of his fathers and ancestors as well. Here, as the good news of Saul's death is proclaimed, as Saul is there dead, the message goes out, not just in the towns, not just in the markets, but in the temples. And as it goes out into the temples, we can't help but remember chapter 4 of 1 Samuel and the fathers of Saul in 1 Samuel. Chapter 4 of 1 Samuel. Saul wasn't around back then, but his fathers and grandfathers were. They were about to be defeated by the Philistine army. And back then they said, quick, we need to get God on our side. And so back then they grabbed the Ark of the Covenant. It was probably the greatest, the ultimate symbol that God was with them. And back then, it was almost like they held God to ransom. It was almost like they had him as a human shield or a divine shield. Because back then, as they were going out to fight the Philistines, they said, send the Ark out in front. Then God will have to give us the victory. Then he'll have to defeat our enemies. Because then, if we send the Ark out in front, it'll be his name that's at stake. It'll be his reputation that's on the line. Surely he wouldn't let them defeat us. Then he'd be the one that would look bad. The Philistines would say, look, we defeated you. We must have defeated your God. And so back then, it was like they had God hostage. It was like they used him as a divine shield. They sent his presence out in front of them so that they would force God to make them win the battle. And back then, you know what God did? He did the unthinkable. Back then, it made our ears tingle just to hear it. God allowed his people to be defeated. He allowed himself to be defeated. He allowed his ark, the Ark of the Covenant, to be taken. His name was blasphemed among the nations. They said, oh, we are the winners. God is weak. This is not the first time we've seen this in 1 Samuel, and it won't be the last. God hands his people over to defeat. No, you could even say God hands himself over to defeat. In many Western countries, what we care most about is our rights and our personal freedoms. But in many Eastern countries and many traditional cultures, it's very important, perhaps even more important, to maintain honour. And maybe you've grown up with this, if you're from a traditional culture or from an Eastern country. It's dominated your life, the honour that you have to always show. More important to maintain honour, even when things are falling apart in your life. More important to maintain the honour, even when everybody knows what's really going on. You just have the honour. Here is something to make your ears tingle. You wouldn't even believe me if I told you. I can only say this after having studied the passage with you. Here is something that will make your ears tingle. God will let you down. God will disappoint. God will hand himself over to defeat. God will lose the battle. It's a prayer that he doesn't answer. It's a healing that he doesn't give. It's a second coming that never comes. The date just comes and goes. And the Philistines rejoice. God's name is blasphemed. They say, ha, where's your God now? God will disappoint you rather than be used by you. God will disappoint you rather than let you go on thinking things are all okay. God will disappoint you rather than turning a blind eye to what's really going on in your heart. He's no Eli. Remember Eli? Way back at the start, how he turned a blind eye to everything his sons were doing? God will lose the battle rather than pretend and protect his honour. Save face. Isn't that amazing? God will lose the battle rather than save face. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says, God suffered shame. He embraced weakness to clear away those who only wanted power from him. Jews demand powerful signs. Greeks want powerful wisdom. That's what they're up for. But God handed himself over to defeat, to be defeated God, so that he would clear them away in their quest for power and their desire for power. If you're trying to use God, if you're trying to use his power, get ready to be disappointed. It won't work. Get ready to be disappointed. But, this is God we're talking about here, and quite obviously he's no ordinary God, even if there is such a thing. Yes, he loses the battle. Yeah, he loses the battle. But in that same moment, he wins the war. Yes, he embraced weakness, but even in that weakness, he is still stronger than man's strength. Even the weakness of God is greater than man's strength. Yes, it was a defeat, but in that very moment of defeat, there was an even bigger, even greater victory that was all happening, that was going on. Because Saul is now gone, everyone. Saul is out of the way, people. The road is clear for King David to finally come to the throne. And man, what a king he's going to be. He's going to be the king after God's own heart. Yes, God loses the battle, but he wins the war because his plans and his purposes for David, at last, they can come. David will be the king after God's own heart, and one of David's family will be on the throne forever. In Acts chapter 13, the Apostle Paul stands up before a synagogue of Judeans and he says, "Look, you scoffers, wonder and perish. I'm going to do something in your days that you wouldn't believe even if someone told you. Let your ears tingle," was what Paul was saying in Acts 13. God's doing something you wouldn't believe. God handed Jesus over to be killed with the help of wicked men. He handed over his glory. Jesus was handed over and the glory departed. But through this, in that moment, salvation comes to the world. Because as the glory departs, the way to be saved shines out. God handed Jesus over to defeat, but in that defeat there was salvation and glory. And then, after all of that, God raised Jesus victorious from the grave as well. Double victory. "Look, you scoffers, wonder and perish. I'm going to do something in your days that you wouldn't believe, even if someone told you." That God would hand himself over to defeat, that is one thing. But that he would be victorious in it, isn't that something? That's something else entirely. That God would hand himself over to defeat, that is one thing. But that he would win a victory in that same moment, that is amazing. People, Christians, not Christians, whoever you are, wherever you're from, be amazed, won't you? Be amazed that this is God. Be amazed that this is how he works. Be amazed that this is what he does. Be amazed that he loses the battle and allows his name to be blasphemed. But then in that moment he wins a victory. Let your ears tingle when you hear that. Let your ears tingle at the sound. Be amazed. But more than that, be challenged. God would rather suffer shame than allow you to carry on a false relationship with him. God would rather suffer shame than allow our world to carry on a false relationship with him. God would rather disappoint you if it'll wake you up to the sort of God that he really is. be amazed, be challenged. But even though it's a victory, even in defeat, even though David came to the throne through Saul's death, like I say, this passage is not yet a cause for celebration. Not yet. Nor is it a cause for exaltation. Though we've been waiting for it, for half the book we've been waiting for it, this is not a moment to rejoice, though. This is a moment to weep. Why? Because even though this is Saul, he still is God's king, and even though this is Saul, God's king is dead. So bow your head, beat your breast, put on clothes of grief. Point one, victory, even in defeat, victory. But then point two, the price, the cost. Point two, God's king is dead. Let's have a look at verse 1, all the way back at the start of our chapter. Chapter 31, verse 1. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell dead on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines were in hot pursuit of Saul and his sons, and they killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day. Well, this passage is trying to emphasize two things to us. Number one, this is Saul. Number two, Saul is dead. In other words, this passage is not about David. It's not even mentioned. Nothing to do with it. He's gone. This passage is not even about Jonathan. Now, he was a great hero. He loved David as a brother. He was faithful to the Lord his God. He was everything that Saul, his father, would never be. And he died too on that day. But he doesn't even hardly get a line to himself in this chapter. He died too, but he hardly even gets a mention. Now later on, thankfully, David will come back and spend some time lamenting for Jonathan. But here now, this passage is about one man and one man only, Saul, the first king of Israel. And what it's saying is, Saul is dead. Verse 1, dead. Verse 5, dead. Verse 6, dead. Verse 7, dead. Verse 8, what does it say? Dead. Five times. Dead, 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 dead. It's trying to emphasize, it's Saul. So even the way the story is told puts the focus entirely on him. He gets separated from his troops in verse 1. And then he gets separated from his sons in verse 2. In verse 3, it's basically Saul left on his own on a mountainside. The passage is narrowing down on him. It's zooming down. It's coming closer to the one that matters. We'll get to Jonathan, yes. We'll get to David, yes. But for now, he's the one who matters. The passage is trying to say two things. Number one, this is Saul. And number two, Saul is dead. There can be no mistake. Dead, 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 dead. We may not respect this man, but we must respect the office. This is God's king. This is the king of God's people. Even though it's Saul, he still is the leader of God's people. That alone is cause for grief when he died. That alone is cause for sorrow and sadness, that the leader of God's people would fall on his own, would come to his end, his demise. That alone is cause for sorrow and sadness. But when you see how he died, how much more is it cause for grief and sorrow and sadness? Like I say, in this passage, Saul's whole life flashes before our eyes. And as he asks his armor-bearer to run him through, we can't help but remember another moment in Saul's life when there was another who could have raised his hand against Saul, when there was another who could have run him through. In fact, it wasn't just once that happened, it was twice that it happened, that Saul was in David's hands. And it wasn't just once, but it was twice that David said, "God forbid that I would raise my hand against him. He's God's king. How could I ever do that?" Here is Saul all alone on the hill, wounded, dying, and he is alone in a sense because even his armor bearer isn't with him. He won't do it. There's not even a Philistine around. It's like in the middle of this giant battle, there's just a moment of still. the eye of the storm, and there is Saul there all alone. And where David wouldn't do it, David wouldn't raise his hand against Saul. Where the unnamed armor bearer wouldn't do it, he won't raise his hand against Saul. Saul will do it. And Saul did it. He did raise his hand against the Lord's anointed, himself. The king who failed to trust God was dead by his own hand. A fitting way to go. His failure was complete. This is God's king. This is the king of God's people. Even though it's Saul, he still is the king. That alone is cause for grief when he died. But when you see how he died, how much more do we lament? You know, some commentaries dispute this. They say he did the right thing by taking his own life because it was God's will that he'd get out of the way so David could come to the throne. And so they say, no, it was actually a heroic thing that he took his life at the end. But aside from the fact that suicide's never good because God made us for life and our lives are in his hands, so aside from that, there's a bigger point. Where David wouldn't raise his hand against, where even an unnamed armor bearer wouldn't raise his hand against, because they said the Lord forbid, Saul did. The king who failed to trust God, dead by his own hand, his failure was complete. What I'm trying to say is this is not a redeeming end for the guy. This is entirely in keeping with who Saul is. This is God's king. That alone is enough. When you see how he died, we lament for him as well. But also, there's another side to all of this. It's not just, you know, who he was, God's king, and it's not just how he died. We also lament because of who he should have been. Like I say, his life is flashing before our eyes. And we read at the end there of the men of Jabesh. Can you see that in verse 11? And as we read of the men of Jabesh in verse 11, it reminds us of chapter 11 of our book, 1 Samuel 11 in our book. Just listen as I read verse 11. Verse 11, when the people of Jabesh Gilead heard that the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men marched through the night to Bethshan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted for 7 days. Back in chapter 11, the men of Jabesh were under attack, and they were under attack from a nation that didn't just go around killing people. Before they killed them, they tortured them and mutilated them, and then they killed them. That was back in chapter 11. Back then, God's spirit came on Saul, and he rose up, and all Israel followed him. And they defeated the threat. Man, what a great day for Saul. You know, as he lay there dying, I'm sure he must have remembered some of those great days that he had. What a happy day as he lay dying. But that day got better, you know, because after he defeated the threat, he led all the people up. And they came before God and they renewed their faith in God. And for just a moment, we got to see what a king should do. For just a glimpse, we got to see how a king should be. That a king led the people to obey and serve the Lord. Oh man, it looked so good in chapter 11. Just for a glimpse, just for a moment, just a waft. This is God's king. The fact that he died, man, that alone is enough to make us weep. But when you see how he died, how much more? But then when you see what he could have been, what he could have been, but he didn't walk with God and he didn't listen to God. And even when Samuel pointed all of this out to him, he still turned away from God. Lament and weep what he could have been. You know, at funerals these days, we have the photo montage where you have the photos and the stories and the songs of someone's life. There are some images here that summarise Saul so well. You know the armour? You know how he keeps on taking his armour off all the way through 1 Samuel and it's symbolic of how he keeps on wanting to give up the kingship? What happens here? His armour is taken off him again. But this time he doesn't choose to do it. It's stripped from him. The kingship stripped away. Or even the old tamarisk tree. See there right at the end? Such an image of Saul's reign, because he used to sit under that tamarisk tree or one like it, and he used to rule from there, and he sought for David with all his strength, like the evil eye looking for David everywhere from under that old tamarisk tree. And he went from suspicious to tormented, to maniacal, under that tamarisk tree, a downward spiral, all the way down. What a fitting end. There he is, again, at the end of his life, under the tamarisk tree. I think that's actually the point of this final episode here, where the men march, valiant men march through the night to recover his body. And it's saying something really profound. It's saying, yeah, this is Saul. We know all about him. We know what he's like. We know the tamarisk tree. We know the armor. We know all about Saul. And yet, look what they do. They say, yes, this is Saul, but God's king is dead. And yes, this is Saul, but he's dead and he's the king. Like these men, we're being led to lament for him. We're being led to lament for who he should have been. You know, many years later, there was another who was God's king. He too was defeated by his enemies. In his death, there was a great victory as well. He too was handed over to the nations to be abused. His body was hung up, public display, humiliation. In his case, there was also someone who came at great risk to themselves. A valiant man came at night and took down his body, gave it a proper burial. All his people fled from the scene. That's as far as it goes when it comes to the similarities. That's as far as it goes when it comes to the similarities between Saul and his death and Jesus and his death. Because really, those similarities between the death of Jesus and the death of Saul, all those similarities really only serve to highlight the differences between the death of Jesus and the death of Saul. Saul died for his own failure to fear the Lord and to serve him faithfully. His own failure. Jesus died as a righteous and faithful one, fully obedient to God to the bitter end. Saul died as a failure. Jesus died as a success. Saul died because he had to. Jesus died because he wanted to. He wanted to die for us. He wanted to be in our place where we should have been. He was there. He was there where we should have been. All those similarities between Jesus and Saul only really serve to highlight the differences between the two. If we lament Saul, how much more should we be lamenting for Jesus? Crossroads, you know, there's so much joy and freedom in being a Christian. We're forgiven. We're made new. We don't need to sin anymore. We don't need to have any fear. We don't even fear death. There's so much joy and freedom in being a Christian because of Jesus. And there's also great humility and sober reflection in being a Christian because of Jesus. Jesus had to die for us, even though he was the king, even though he was righteous, even though he was faithful. In fact, it was his faithfulness that took him to the bitter end, to the cross. Even though he was all of that, he was in a place of horror. He was in a place of abuse and cuts and scars and wounds. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was wounded for our iniquity. The king, God's king, the one, wounded. You see what I'm saying? If you want to be wise, you'll live with joy and freedom. Jesus died for you. You'll live with joy and freedom. You'll be wise. But if you want to be wise, you'll also live with soberness and humility. Jesus had to die for you. He had to die. So you need to learn to live with that soberness and that humility. That is wise. Well, we come to the end of 1 Samuel. It's only taken 5 winters. It's only taken 5 years. Come to the end. But, you know, even if we did go into 2 Samuel, which we won't this year, but even if we did, you know what we'd find? The very next chapter of the very next book of the Bible is still not a celebration. Not yet. It's still not an exaltation. Not even then. The very next chapter of the Bible, you know what it does? It brings us straight back here. And it says, did you look? Did you listen? Did you learn to lament? Did you learn to be wise? Because yes, there was a great victory. Even in defeat, there was a great victory. But also in that defeat, God's king died. Let's pray.